Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Greenwashed here with Don and Jaspreet. Hope you're having a great morning so far. We've had a good one. What we're speaking with Brian Leland and all the feedback that we've got over the last week. Hey, Don.
Yeah, it's been a great morning. We are having a wee giggle off air about some of the subjects we're going to have coming up. And it's hard to keep a straight face, isn't it?
It is very hard to keep a straight face, but it's time for Dawn and me to get into the climate crazy and hopefully come out sane at the end of all of this.
Oh, look, there's nothing sane about the stuff we're coming up with. But yeah, hopefully you're right. We'll come out sane and hopefully show people that perhaps aren't quite as sane as us. I know that sounds arrogant, but let's hope people agree with us at the end of it.
Yep. And I thought, where else to begin from but the Olympics that are not very far towards the end of July in Paris this time around. And when I was a child, we even know about the Olympics, you know, we'd be counting down weeks and months in advance and the opening ceremony and what was that and matching that with India time. Somehow, over the last few years, all of that has lost its charm for me. But one thing I certainly take an interest in is if there's suddenly sustainability credentials being flaunted. And the Paris 2024 Olympics have a food vision.
Yeah,
and sustainability vision.
I can't believe that you're not so focused on the performance of the athletes anymore. Gee. I used to think the Olympics were a pinnacle of everything, really, in terms of sporting achievement, especially in the pre-professional era of sport. You know, there's been a lot of professionalism in the last 30 years. It's taken the edge off my interest in all this stuff, really. But yeah, look, let's focus on the plants of France and how they're going to feed these people.
How they're going to nourish these super athletes, indeed.
Yeah,
and they want to green the plates and at the Paris Olympics. And Paris 2024 aims to halve the carbon footprint of catering at the Olympics. And the Paris 2024 document shows how they plan to do that. They have 24 targets for sustainable catering, a collective approach to doing so. They have commitments to catering during and beyond the games. They also have aspirational goals, shall we say, of encouraging the Paris 2024 ecosystem to look beyond the scope of the games. And you know what they mean when they talk about sustainable meals, don't we? They say there's 13 million meals that are going to be served during the Olympics. And the organizers see it as a monumental opportunity to spotlight cuisines that are not just delectable, but come with lower environmental impact. After all, what else would you be looking at when you're looking at the pinnacle of human achievement in sports?
Yeah, you won't be having red meat, would you? No red meat there. Couldn't
None.
Be.
Mm-hmm.
Funny, isn't it? Because the French cuisine in general has a lot of red meat. A lot of beef, especially a lot of poultry,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of bread. Having been to France a few times, I know that's what they like to eat. I mean, I think I'd favour a croque monsieur over a snail or an escargot, but certainly I'd favour both of them over a dish of ratatouille or something like that. But that's just me, Jasper. That's just me.
That's Don showing off his gastronomic credentials. But let's go through further to the document called Paris 2024 Food Vision. It says that they are looking at WWF, the World Wildlife Fund's table of recommendations regarding certification of their suppliers up and down the supply chain. And the commitment of the caterers is at least a 50% reduction and, if possible, 60% reduction of animal products, meat, fish, dairy products, eggs, etc., in all the food compared with the first year that this particular food charter was signed, as well as the systematic inclusion of a balanced vegetarian menu.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, you know, if you're a food producer in France, you'd like to think that the showcase of the Olympics is going to be using everything you could sort of supply them with. And you know, all this stuff looks nice, but look, I see they're still going to have the odd sandwich and things like that. You know, the basic foods.
They want to reduce emissions, Don. They say they want to reduce carbon emissions and measure the preservation of the environment. There's going to be local food, which I agree with, procured from sectors respecting animal welfare. I thought most countries had animal welfare standards. Value farmers committed to preserving the environment, optimize logistics. All right, nothing wrong in that if you can do it. But there's going to be diversity, equity, and all as well.
Vital, you have diversity and equity. So that means you're going to have some plants and you're going to have some meat, doesn't it?
No, it does talk about diversity, equity, and social innovation. Otherwise, it's they are looking for vegan foods. The Athletes Village Dining Hall will offer 500 recipes, and at least a third of the dishes will be entirely plant-based. At the La Concorde venue, 100% of the food served to visitors will be vegetarian. And by the end of it, Paris 2024 will halve the carbon footprint of catering at the Olympics.
Well, gosh, it's going to make a massive difference to the world. And I know that sounds all a bit glib, but, you know, I just, people that get to the Olympics, the athletes and the visitors and the patrons that watch, they just want to go there and have a good time and do their best, don't they? Hopefully they do enjoy the food that's on offer. I'm sure they will. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, if there's any complaints. But, you know, when you're a finely tuned athlete, people do have their diets they prefer. So, you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of cultures there. How are they going to cover the different cultures and the food that different cultures expect? That would be more interesting, I would have thought.
Who knows? But when you said, when suddenly everything becomes about climate and cutting meat and cutting dairy and carbon emissions, I'm sure the ancient Greeks did not think of this when the Olympics first started. But here we are in this century. Everything is about virtue signaling. And as they say, pulses, beans and chickpeas are going to occupy center stage. Fabulous.
And I see where the, while it's talked in Paris as the, perhaps the epicenter of the Olympics, I see there are going to be events in Lyon and Marseille as well, by the look of it. So I'm not quite sure what events they will be, but it's not just going to be in downtown Paris. Or actually, it's not downtown, it's on the periphery of Paris, isn't it?
Temperatures, it's going to be a spectacle. There are going to be some accountants very busy crunching numbers on the carbon emissions. And that is pretty much, for me, epitomizes climate crazy, as you know, how more mad can we get in this?
Well, look, if you want to be absolutely climate crazy, every athlete that goes here should have to measure their footprint from the beginning of they started training right through to the time they get on the plane or train and end in Paris, and their whole footprint while they're there, they wouldn't be able to go because no one would be able to afford any of this. That's how crazy that is. If everyone was true to their word, they would calculate things to the minutiae, and this would stop a project like the Olympics. It just wouldn't happen.
No, why should we be having them in sports at the cost of environmental Armageddon? Hell no.
Yeah.
Stay home. Save lives. Isn't that the message we had a few years ago? Stay home and save lives. Save the earth.
Yeah, I know we're sounding a bit crazy, but look, it gets worse, doesn't it? The next climate crazy is the Russia's war with Ukraine is accelerating carbon emissions and climate change. Well, you have to, this has been published. It's a story in The Guardian, but I think it's The Guardian, but you know, war's not for sissies, is it? War's not for sissies. No one's going to be worried about calculating your carbon emissions while you're trying to survive. Sure, there's going to be buildings demolished and will need to be rebuilt if they ever get a chance. But we're worried about that in the middle of a massive altercation between two countries? I don't think so. Are you worried about it? I'm worried about the war. I certainly am not worried about the emissions given off by that war or the rebuild emissions in the future.
But they
should
said
I be worried? Am I being a bit selfish here?
Don, you are not an expert. And what they say is that this is the most detailed analysis of the impact of this, ecological impact of war ever undertaken. There's a greenhouse gas accounting initiative for war. I mean, for crying out loud, that's what they think is should take center stage when there is carnage at the scale that we are told is being happening. Somehow, in the middle of all this carnage, we have seen Zelensky, the president, although always dressed in fatigues, no doubt, take the time out with the first lady for a photo shoot with one of these outfits, Vogue or Harper's Bazaar or some such thing. But hey, let us count the greenhouse gas emissions impact of this conflict. Doesn't get crazier than that.
I don't think so. I mean, let's put these people on the front line and see how they go. I mean, I think we've all become so damned entitled. We've forgotten about realism. You know, I've always considered myself ultra lucky not to have had to go into the defense force when I was in the 60s. It was close. The ballot was just sort of taken off New Zealand's. Yeah, the compulsory military training was taken out of the rule book about 1970-ish. And I just escaped that. And I thought, phew, that was lucky. But looking back, I have a bit of feeling about developing your patriotism through military training wouldn't have been a bad idea.
Yeah.
And it would have made us feeling less entitled than we are today. I just find this stuff galling.
It is very, very galling. But as I say, that so far, the report goes on to say, there's always been patchy or non-existent data on the military-industrial complex's cost impact on climate due to secrecy and limited frontline access for researchers. But this new report by the Greenhouse Gas Accounting Initiative on War, IGGAW, has said that the Russian Federation now faces a $32 billion climate reparations bill for the first 24 months of war. A climate reparations bill for war. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So have war, other people will pay. We'll all be in the mix for the payment of that through some big international fund. Is that right, Jasper? Is that how you're reading that?
Yep. Maybe we should all just hand over that to the UN Security Council, shouldn't we?
Well, actually, Grant Robertson, former Minister of Finance and the former Prime Minister, would be good at it because they could print money and they could share it all over Ukraine if they want to. It's just magic.
Yeah, the only difference is that the government prints money. It's legal. If you and I do it, Don, we're in trouble.
Mm. Yeah, so off the sheep's back and off the land, they expect to pay all the bills again. I look at how does this stuff get even legs, Jasper? I cannot believe this stuff gets legs. People get an employment, some employment out of it. Some consultant gets to do this. It's wearisome.
Yep, there's someone making money. This climate.
Someone making.
The climate carnage certainly has gravy trains for a whole lot of people.
Yeah. And of course, added to that, we've got the crazy stuff on greenhouse gas that's so potent. It's so, so potent. It's 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. That's nitrous oxide. And it's gone up. It's just gone crazy in recent years. It's gone up 40% since about, 1750?
Yep, industrialization.
But more recently, it's definitely caused by ag use of urea.
But
it's the problem. And so when you see the graph on that article, it looks like it's almost an exponential lift. It's talking parts per billion over a very short time frame. They make it look far more accentuated than it really is. Did you think that graph was drawn up for effect?
That was drawn up for effect. We parts per million is bad enough. Now we're talking about parts per billion of nitrous oxide. Come on, guys, spin me a new one.
And of course, we know, we've told our listeners many times over, that if you listen to the latest and greatest science on methane or nitrous oxide, let alone CO2, there is nothing to see here. nothing to see. It's all overshadowed by water vapor. And so, you know, but nothing like a good headline that says that the growth in emissions of forgotten greenhouse gas nitrous oxide is speeding up, say study. Well, heck, another one.
Another one. Experts.
And where did that come from? Was that Australia?
That was ABC, yep, Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Gosh, they need to come to New Zealand and learn a bit, don't they?
Well, from ABC to the BBC, that recently published an article saying, be ambitious on climate, scientists urge parties. This was middle of last week, 3-4 days ago. It says that an open letter has been published saying that all UK parties should commit to an ambitious program of climate policies according to a group of UK's leading climate experts. This open letter that was published last Monday had the academics saying if parties do not make this pledge, they are not worthy of support, as the parties in UK are now expected to announce their manifestos for the July election soon. The BBC gushes over this letter, saying that 408 members of the UK's climate science community have signed this. And yet, when you go to the details, as the Daily Skeptic reports, some of those 408 climate scientists are psychologists, accountants, and landscape designers.
They're totally qualified. I mean, it's a bit like the 97% consensus story, isn't it? But here they have 408 people. You couldn't say they're all climate scientists, that's for sure, wanting to sign up to this idealistic pledge. And it's interesting. There's a Grantham organization behind it as well. And it's hard to explain it clearly on the radio without, you know, on an interview without perhaps stuffing it up a little bit. But the Grantham organization is well funded, and so well funded that tens of millions of dollars are going through the machinery, through the Climate Foundation, Climate Works Foundation, Environmental Defence Fund. The Imperial College is about £30 million gone through that in 15-odd years. The London School of Economics, £30 million in about 15 years. The European Climate Fund, about £10 million in the last 6 or 7 years. So it's a big player. The Grantham Greta files are out and about. They're really hamming it up and hopefully going to influence the election. And it just shows you how the corporates are controlling this stuff, isn't it? The corporates are behind really pushing their agenda here.
They now call it eco-journalism. So the Grantham operation that's been funding many of these so-called climate articles, behind them is the green billionaire investor Jeremy Grantham. He's big-time invested in green tech or anything to do with climate change. And, of course, he funds these institutes. These organizations to the tune of tens of millions of pounds to publish.
Well, it looks like it's heading towards £100 million in the last 15 years over various organizations. So why would he do that if he wasn't going to be profiting somewhere? He must be worried about his future, perhaps.
His economic future, not his climate future, though.
Oh, if the net zero thing bubble bursts, all of a sudden his return, his payback might just not be as good as he wanted it to be.
Yep.
But having not researched him deeply, it's concerning though, isn't it, Jaspery, that this is happening the world over. This is only one example.
This is only one example in the West. You just have to go, listeners, if you've just joined us, just go to earthjournalism.net. This is possibly the world's largest eco-journalism or eco-climate porn, as I call it, that funding network, earthjournalism.net. And you just have to go there and look at opportunities that are available right now. Just money ready to be dished out. There's Earthshots, training and grant opportunities for social media content producers in the Philippines, fellowships for journalists to cover the UN biodiversity conferences. There is communicators workshop for renewable energy in India. Communicators workshop. So basically, you are creating figureheads who will speak for it. You are paying them to go and put these stories out. You know, not very different, Don, from the Public Interest Journalism Fund that we had in New Zealand.
it's the ultimate nudge unit, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The ultimate nudge unit, to use the term of that organization, that Behavioral Insights terms their influencing nudge. Yeah, they develop these nudge units. This is very similar.
So the Earth Journalism Network is really, really insidious. And if you go to their website and you look at those who are funding it, everyone from the Hewitt Foundation to the World Bank to the World Resource Institute to the Smithsonian to anyone who's anyone, they are funding this outfit, the Buffett Foundation. It is the Ford Foundation, and I mean, I could go on, but the point being here is, if this was all so dangerous, you wouldn't need to spend money to seed fear into people's minds. The very fact that they have this Earth Journalism Network, where they fund these geojournalists, as they call it, a truth does not need money being sprayed so liberally. It would just be obvious to all of us.
Well, you would have thought so. And you would have thought that the biodiversity protection that a lot of these people are on about would be, as you say, more enhanced if the money was left to real people, to, you know, at the coalface effectively, to do the enhancement or the protections these people demand. They have to wash so much money through their entities before anything might hit the ground. That's the problem. Dead weight loss of these organizations.
Completely. And no one seems to think that this is odd, the fact that journalists are being paid. I've always said, anything you subsidize, you get more of it. You subsidize fear porn, you subsidize climate fear porn, you're going to get more of it. And here we have literally hundreds of millions of dollars being dished out everywhere. And when you have those dished out to poorer countries, developing economies, Philippines, India, and so on, to social media content creators, creating climate influencers. I mean, I remember a time when there were makeup and all of those sort of influencers. We've gone that to now to this extreme end. Yeah, all you are doing is whipping up climate hysteria and the youth. This is not going to end well.
No, and it's happening right here at home, isn't it? Yeah, where more and more people are saying we have to encourage our youth to be more interested in this stuff and create that tension. So when I see the school, you know, one of the, was it the Kapiti Coast? No, it was the adaptation submission process has lots of influences from secondary school children. I mean, you wonder who is making them do that. Is it the teachers, or is it some greater influencer? And it probably is some greater influencer getting in through their education system. I see one of the providers in that, the funders in that, was an outfit called GRID, G-R-I-D, and it was a center collaborating with the UNEP, your favorite place.
United Nations Environmental Program, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny how all roads lead to Rome, or should I say Geneva, in this case.
Yeah. So have we got anything else left in our crazies for this week?
It's been really crazy this week. Well, let's just go to one more. And this is now California. Californians are finding that their roads need more money because they're typically maintained with gas tax revenue, but that's dwindling because Californians have very enthusiastically uptaken electric vehicles. And California now has more than 1.2 million hybrids or EVs in the city, which means gas revenues have fallen rapidly. EVs have a $100 annual registration charge. Other vehicles are $300. Over 1 million EVs, that's a $200 million loss annually, ballpark. So California is now proposing what it calls, California Transport, called Caltrans, is proposing a Californian road charge, which would tax drivers on the number of miles they drive. What a surprise.
Well, nothing wrong with that. Taxing, you know, we get taxed on miles we drive in our diesels. We get taxed road user charges there. We get fuel excise and petrol vehicles. And only in April this year did we fix the problem where EVs were getting a free ride. And when even hybrids were effectively not paying their dues. So at least we're ahead of California. But it looks like there's more surveillance going on even in than Californians would like. But isn't this is the perverse reaction when you subsidize so many cars so quickly, well, subsidize them at all, and they become dominant in your, you know, a significant force in your transport fleet. They were getting a free ride and they just didn't like, they just are going to struggle to say, we've got to pay now, and the Californians won't like it.
Every fairy tale must come to an end. In this case, California Transport says that the mileage could be tracked, as Don says, a surveillance thing, could be tracked by plugging an electronic device into the vehicle, using the vehicle's built-in tracking system, or simply submitting photos of the vehicle's odometer. Nothing wrong in telling Big Brother everything. After all, we have nothing to hide. What's a little bit of more surveillance between the government and police, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I have no issue with the road users funding, fully funding the roads. I just wished that's how it was. Road users are who uses the road. It's also, roads are also part of an economy. You have to have roads to move people around and goods and services. So funding the roads on based on use seems fair to me.
Based on the mileage, perhaps you could just extend that this many miles are this much carbon emitted. Who knows what? For the others, there could be an additional carbon tax on top, whatever. The mind boggles. There are possibilities endless.
Well, of course, all New Zealanders are paying an emissions charge now on their fuel. So we're ahead of the Americans, are we? Are we ahead of them?
We are. We've certainly stupid, not yet.
Ahead of them in stupidity, or are we smart? Gosh. Yeah, but anyway, look, climate crazies, there's plenty of them. It doesn't matter where you look. I mean, it's hard to keep a straight face while we're doing this stuff. I mean, and we are so serious on so many other things. But yeah, every week there's more. And, you know, they'll keep coming as long as this nonsense is in front of us. But I'd say the world's got bigger things to face than emissions charges.
You've got to have a laugh when you can in these times, John. I enjoy this.
Anyway, we'll go to a break now, but after the break, we'll have Professor John Hickford. Now, he's in the Faculty of Ag and Life Sciences at Lincoln University, and he's taken some issue with the funding of sciences in New Zealand, especially agricultural sciences. So we're going to get his view on that and quite a few other issues after the break.
So thank you so much for joining us today. 2057 is a number, and you can email us at inbox@theratorealitycheck.radio. Hope you enjoyed the climate crazy. See you in a moment.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.